Katrina must have read Ramon's mind, for she dropped her voice to a whisper. "Will you dine at the flat tonight before you leave? Mama has found an excellent sausage and a bottle of vodka." "Very well, little one," he agreed, and then went through to his own office. The green flash box was on his desk, and he unbuttoned his tunic and split the security seal that the cipher department had affixed. As he read the code Red Rose, he felt a sharp elevation of his pulse rate. That annoyed him. Red Rose was merely an agent, like 100 others under his control. If he allowed personalities to intrude, his own efficiency was diminished. Even so, as he lifted the Red Rose folder from the box, he was struck suddenly by a mental image of a naked girl perched on a black boulder in a Spanish mountain stream. The picture was extraordinarily vivid, even down to the deep indigo blue of her eyes. He opened the file and saw at a glance that it was the report on the South African naval radar chain that he had called for. It had come in via the London embassy bag. He nodded with satisfaction and then consulted his daybook. With the log open before him, he lifted the handset of his departmental intercom and dialed records. A printout. "Reference Protea, item number 1178. Urgent, please." While he waited for the printout to be delivered, he rose from his desk and crossed to the windows. The view was novel enough to engage his interest. Over the statue of the founder, he looked across the stately forest of buildings to the colourful onion-shaped domes of the Cathedral of St. Basil the Blessed and the walls of the Kremlin. He was still disturbed by the memories that the Red Rose dispatch had evoked. On a logical train of thought, his mind went on to the journey that would begin for him at midnight from Sheremetyevo Airport, and the child who would be waiting for him at the journey's end. He had not seen Nicholas for over 2 months. He would have grown again, and he would be speaking even more fluently. His vocabulary was quite unusual for his age. Paternal pride was a bourgeois emotion, and Ramon sought to suppress it. He should not be standing dreaming out of the window while there was so much work to be done. He checked his wristwatch. In 48 minutes there was a meeting scheduled, the result of which would vitally affect his career over the next decade. He returned to his desk and took his notes for the meeting from the top drawer. Katrina had typed them out in double spacing. He flipped through the pages and found that he still knew every word by heart. His presentation was memorized and word perfect. Further study would only affect the spontaneity of his delivery. He set the report aside. At that moment there was a knock on the door, and Katrina ushered the records clerk into his office. Ramon signed for the computer printout in the records book, and after Katrina and the clerk had left, he slit the envelope and spread the printout on its desk. Protea was the code name of another of his South African agents. His real name was Dieter Reinhardt, a German national, born in Dresden in 1930. His father had commanded one of Admiral Dönitz's U-boats with distinction. After the partition of Germany, Reinhardt had enrolled as a cadet officer in the fledgling navy of the German Democratic Republic, and 2 years later had been recruited by the KGB. Subsequently, his so-called escape over the Berlin Wall to the west had been carefully stage-managed by Joe Cicero personally. Reinhardt and his wife had emigrated to South Africa in 1960, and after he had become a naturalized South African citizen, he had joined the South African Navy and worked his way up to the rank of Commandant. He was presently Chief of Signals on headquarters staff at Silvermine Command Bunker. The printout was a copy of the report that he had filed 3 weeks previously concerning the Siemens radar chain at Silvermine. Ramon laid the Red Rose report of the same installation alongside Proteus and began comparing them item by item, paragraph by paragraph. Within 10 minutes he was satisfied that they were in total agreement, in general and in detail. The integrity of Protea was of the highest order. It had been tested repeatedly over a decade, and long ago rated Class 1, the highest category source. Red Rose had just survived her first security check. She could now be considered as active and given a Class 3 rating. After almost 4 years of carefully executed preparation, Ramon considered the price acceptable. He smiled at the portrait of Leonid Brezhnev on the opposite wall, and the General Secretary stared back at him solemnly from under beetling brows. Katrina rang through on his private line, Comrade Colonel, you are expected on the top floor in 6 minutes. Thank you, comrade. Please come through to witness destruction of documents. She stood at his side while he fed the printout of the Protea report into the paper shredder and then countersigned the entry in his daybook to attest to the destruction. She watched him button his tunic and adjust the block of medal ribbons on his chest in the small wall mirror. Then she handed him the sheaf of notes for the meeting. A good luck, Comrade Colonel. She stood close to him with face upturned. Thank you. He turned away without touching her. Never in the office. Ramon waited alone in the secure conference room on the top floor. They kept him waiting for 10 minutes. The walls of the room were bare plaster, painted white. There was no panelling that might conceal a microphone. Apart from the obligatory portraits of Lenin and Brezhnev, there was no decoration. There were a dozen chairs at the long conference table, and Ramon stood for the full 10 minutes at the lower end. At last, the door from the director's suite opened. General Yuri Borodin was head of the Fourth Directorate. In his new capacity, Ramon reported directly to him. He was a chunky, grey-haired septuagenarian, a cautious, devious man in a shiny striped suit. Ramon admired him and held him in awe. The man that followed him into the conference room deserved even greater respect. He was younger than Borodin, not much over 50, and yet he was already a member of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet and a deputy minister at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Ramon's report had drawn a much heavier reaction than he had anticipated. He was being invited to defend his thesis in front of one of the 100 most influential men in Russia. Alexei Yudinich was short and slight in stature, but he had the fierce, penetrating gaze of a mystic. He shook Ramon's hand briefly and stared into his eyes for a moment while Borodin introduced them, and then he took the seat at the head of the table with his aides on each side of him. "You have novel ideas, young man," he began abruptly, and his choice of adjectives was not necessarily complimentary. Youth was not a commodity by which the Department of Foreign Affairs set as much store as they did by traditional and well-tried policies. You wish to abandon our long-standing support for the liberation movements in Southern Africa, the African National Congress and the South African Communist Party, and for the armed struggle in Southern Africa in general? With respect, Comrade Director, Ramon replied carefully, that is not my intention. Then I have misread your paper. Have you not stated that the ANC has proved to be the most inept and unproductive guerrilla organization in modern history? I have pointed out the reasons for this and the manner in which previous mistakes may be rectified. Yudinich grunted and turned a sheet of his copy of the report. Continue. Explain to me why the armed struggle should not succeed in South Africa, as it did in, for instance, Algeria. There are basic differences, Minister. The settlers in Algeria, the Pieds Noirs, were Frenchmen, and France was a short boat ride away across the Mediterranean. The white Afrikaner has no such escape route. He stands with his back to the Atlantic Ocean. He must fight. Africa is his motherland.
Yes, Yudinich nodded. Continue.
The FLN guerrillas in Algeria were united by the Muslim religion and a common language. They were waging a holy war, a jihad. On the other hand, the black Africans are not so inspired. They are splintered by language and tribal enmities. And the ANC, as an example, is an almost exclusively Xhosa tribal organization, which excludes the most numerous and powerful tribe, the Zulu nation, from its ranks. Yudinich listened for 15 minutes without interruption. His gaze never left Ramon's face. When at last Ramon finished speaking, he asked softly,
"So, what is the alternative that you propose?"
"Not an alternative," Ramon shook his head. "The armed struggle must, of course, continue. There are younger, brighter, and more committed men coming forward in its ranks, men like Rally Tabaka. From them we may see greater successes in future. What I propose is an adjunct to the struggle, an economic onslaught, a series of boycotts and mandatory sanctions."
"We do not have economic contacts with South Africa," Yudinich pointed out brusquely.
"I propose that we let our arch-enemy do the job for us. I propose that we orchestrate in America and Western Europe a campaign to destroy the South African economy. Let our enemies prepare the ground for us and plant the seeds of revolution.
We will harvest the fruits. And how do you suggest we go about this?
You know that we have excellent penetration of the American Democratic Party. We have access at the highest possible levels to the American media. Our influence in such organizations as the NAACP and the Trans-Africa Foundation is pervasive. I propose that we make South Africa and apartheid a rallying cry for the American left. They are looking for a cause to unite them. We will give them that cause. We will make South Africa a domestic political issue in the United States of America. The black Americans will flock to the standard, and to secure their votes, the Democratic Party will follow them. We will orchestrate a campaign in the ghettos and on the campuses of America for comprehensive mandatory sanctions that will destroy the South African economy and bring its government crashing down in ruins, unable any longer to protect itself or to keep its security forces in the field. When that happens, we will step in and place our own surrogate government in power. They were silent a while, contemplating this startling vision. Alexei Yudinich coughed and asked quietly, "How much will this cost in financial terms?"
"Billions of dollars," Ramon admitted.
And when Yudinich's expression tightened, he went on, "Billions of American dollars, Comrade Minister. We will let the Democratic Party call the tune for us, and the American people can pay the piper."
Minister Yudinich smiled for the first time that afternoon. The discussions lasted another 2 hours before Yuri Borodin rang the bell to summon his aide.
"Vodka," he said.
It came on a silver tray, the bottle thickly crusted with frost from the freezer. Alexei Yudinich gave them the first of many toasts.
"The Democratic Party of America!"
And they laughed and drained their glasses, and shook hands and clapped each other's backs. Director Borodin moved slightly, until he and Ramon Machado were standing shoulder to shoulder. It was a gesture that was not lost on any of them. He was aligning himself with his brilliant young subordinate.
Katrina's flat was in one of the more pleasant sections of the city. From her bedroom window there was a view of Gorky Park and the amusement ground. On the skyline, the big Ferris wheel, lit with myriad fairy lights, revolved slowly against the cold grey clouds as Ramon stepped out of the Chaika and went in through the front entrance of the apartment building. It was a relic from pre-revolutionary Tsarist Russia, a wedding cake of a building in Rococo style. There was no lift, and Ramon climbed the stairs to the sixth floor. The exercise helped clear the vodka fumes from his brain. Katrina's mother had lovingly prepared the thick pork sausage with a side dish of cabbage. Always cabbage. The entire apartment block smelt of boiled cabbage. Katrina's parents treated Ramon with servile and fawning respect. Her mother served Ramon with the greater portion of the sausage, while Katrina poured pepper vodka into his tumbler. When they had eaten, Katrina's parents took the child with them and went to watch television in a neighbour's apartment, discreetly leaving Ramon and Katrina to say their farewells. "I shall miss you," Katrina whispered, as she led him to the single bed in her tiny room and let the skirt of her tunic fall around her ankles. "Please return soon." They had an hour before Ramon had to leave for the airport. Her skin was velvety smooth and warm to his touch. There were tiny blue veins radiating out from around her large rosy brown nipples. There was plenty of time for Ramon to make it really good for her. He left her with barely enough strength to totter to the door. The threadbare dressing gown was clutched around her flawless shoulders, and her crisp curls were in tangled disarray. At the door she leant heavily against him and kissed him deeply.
"Oh, come back soon, please, oh, please,"